so just notice we're still alive. So from the Buddhist perspective, which is the view we're discussing in this room, that's because we've still got petrol tank, still got gas in our petrol tank, petrol in our petrol tank, and the petrol, it's the petrol tank of non-killing. In particular, the one that's called, the third one is called experience is similar to the cause, which is the result of non-killing and the karmic result. Huh?
Sorry, we're
what?
Sleeping.
It's raining.
Oh.
I'll get
involved. Okay, we'll stop then. Wait till it stops sleeping. It was a good sign, purification. So just all moving your chair, just move in a bit. Move forward a bit. So just move over, away from the window then. It's a bit chilly in here, isn't it? Aren't you a bit chilly?
Yep.
It's chilly, isn't it? Is there any blankets? Can I have a blanket, Mummy?
Yes.
For my bottom? My feet and my head stay really hot and toasty, but my bottom always stays cold. Too much information. For the Chinese, that's your kidneys, isn't it?
Yeah.
So my kidneys mustn't be.
What if your feet and hands are cold? What's that?
I don't know. I have no idea. Don't know. Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you, darling.
Would anyone else like a blanket?
Yeah, there
must
be blankets there.
There's a few outside.
Yeah, get warm. You should have double glazing here. That's what you need, isn't
it?
Well,
it's on the list.
Oh, is it really? Yes. Oh, how wonderful. Yes. Yes. Good.
The roof and
the roof and the...
The roof, which I thought
roof
you
is helpful.
Praying would hold out. No, it's been fixed a couple of times, but when the wind blows in a certain direction with the ferocity that it's blowing...
It's been blowing at the moment. It's quite a strong one, isn't it?
And the rain, it's... Simple, but it's certainly on the list, and it's going to be. I think it's starting in April.
What is
the
roofing?
The roof. Mm,
the oh, good.
And this area here as well.
All right.
And the windows.
Good.
With the manifolds.
That's right. Okay, we're still alive. Didn't die then.
Slightly wet.
I mean, it's really interesting, this one of impermanence, but we'll just practice, you know. There's an assumption. This is the thing. These delusions, the Buddha is saying, are the primordially deep assumptions. When you just take something for granted, that means you no longer think about it. You don't see the meaning of it. It's a very interesting point. So we just assume, well, of course I'm alive. I'm me, you know. Because we're so grasping, so much attachment. We just assume because I'm alive now. Of course I'm alive, we think. We have no sense of, you know, impermanence. It's a very simple point. We'll discuss it. So we have to argue with it. But we have to try and be amazed, you know. Wow, I'm still alive. Can't believe it. We have to practice counteracting the wrong view with the right view. Because we're impermanent. And because we're not clairvoyant, we do not know when we will die. That's good. That should scare the life out of us. But of course it doesn't. So, okay. So then the conclusion from this, what's the action point from this fact that we're still alive, is not to waste it. Not to waste it, thinking, okay, we're sitting here for this reason, we're going to sit here, take some advice from the Buddha to see if there's anything we'd like to put into practice, you know, to develop our amazing potential, so we can help others. That's why we're sitting here. And we'll express this in our little prayer. Sangye charang soke chognam la jantro baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la jantro baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye Chodan soke chog nam la, chang chu ba du dag ni kyab su chi, dagi chon yen gi pe sonam ki, jola pen chi sangge drup pa shok. So let's talk about impermanence, you know. The way they structure the teachings, the way this packaging of teachings, the way the Buddha's teachings are packaged and presented by the Tibetans. The essence of the junior school practice, the essence of it is to abide by the laws of karma, to practice ethics, in entry-level, junior school, urgent level of practice, and least refrain from harming sentient beings. Why? Because that leaves imprints in our mind that will ripen in the future as our suffering. First level of practice. But to even get to the point of wanting to practice, you know, Atisha, who's the sort of the source of this approach, when he came to Tibet from India, he was this great Indian master, scholar, you know, yogi, was invited and lived sometime in the 11th century, I can't remember, invited to Tibet. And he kind of put together he wrote this little book, this little text called Light That Guides You On Your Way, sort of thing. Because you could see that the Buddhism had been there since the 7th century, flourishing in Tibet. But somehow there was no really coherent overview about where everything fits. Which I think, as I said before, is really not how we think of spiritual teachings at all. You know, when you study maths or music or cooking even, you start at the simple stuff, you go to the middle stuff, and you go to the most advanced, and then you graduate. Well, that's how what this lam rim is. Initially, it's hard to see how it's... What does it mean even, you know? I know when I first heard Lama Zopa's teachings, I had no idea what he was talking about. So the thing we need to do is energize ourselves to even want to enter into the path, to even want to begin to practice. So our teacher gets us to think about impermanence, kind of gives us a wake-up call. Not impermanence about everything, because everything is impermanent, but he gets us right between the eyeballs, and he gets us to think about the impermanence of this person, me, and that's called death. So he kind of, there's three bullet points. So the first one he gets us to think about, and all of these points, you see, the one way of approaching all of Buddhism from A to Z is it's a presentation of Buddha's own experiential findings about how things exist. It is really an overview, it's a worldview. That's what it is, actually. It's his presentation of what he has found to be how things are. Quite literally, that's it. So what he's saying is, this is his main point, this is how things are, but right now, folks, I'm very sorry, you're living in la-la land. Because in our minds, we have these layers upon layers upon layers of misconceptions about how things are that are completely, you know, being misconceptions, completely conflict with how things are. So there's this massive disconnect between how we think things are, what we expect things to be, the way we believe things are, and how things are. And this is the source of suffering. That's his point. It's quite odd to think of it that way. But that's exactly what he's saying. In other words, it's like if you've got a 5-pound note, but you believe it's 50, you're in serious trouble. You really believe it's worth 50. You go off and spend it to get 50, and you're disappointed every time. That's what he says about all the different views in our mind. Our minds are full of these layers and layers and layers and layers of literally misconceptions, some of which are enormous emotional component. So one of these misconceptions, he would say, is that we think someone made us. He thinks that's the wackiest idea he's ever heard. Of course, the Buddha doesn't talk like that. He's polite. But there's a very simple way of putting it. And this is the point. It's because this is the thing to hear. You don't have to believe Buddha. He's not asking you to believe him. You've really got to think that. You've really got to remember that. Because that's how we think of religion. I'm not supposed to believe it. That's superstition. It's absurd. It's just laziness, intellectual laziness to believe something, merely believe. You've got to start believing because you can't know it immediately. But you don't just believe any old Joe because they tell you something. You just don't go off to a doctor because they look cute and then believe whatever they tell you. You've got to do some research first and have some confidence. This is a crucial point. Have some confidence based on your own research that this person is worthy of you listening to and therefore trusting. It's really logical. We all do that. Well, the Buddha, the same. Check up best you can on the teachings, on the past, on the history, looking at it, looking into it, and I think in particular looking at the current exponents of it. That should give us great confidence, you know. A doctor is just an exponent of a certain medical system. So you've got to get some confidence. It's very practical. So what Buddha's saying is that our minds, or as Lama Zopa puts it, all these misconceptions, some of which have an emotional component, enormously emotional, is these delusions, and that's one of the key words indicating the function of these, their disturbing emotions, their misconceptions, their delusions, as various synonyms for these ridiculous states of mind. That we, of course, in our culture think are normal. Keep remembering that. Anger, attachment, jealousy, something simple, or a misconception that you're made by somebody. What is not being rude? He has found from his own direct experience that just simply isn't true. And he's not asking us to believe him. That's superstition. That's bullying us. That's what we think of religion. You're supposed to believe it. I mean, Einstein does not demand that you believe that E equals MC squared. He says, here's my findings, honey. Over to you if you're interested. You have to prove it yourself. That's exactly how Buddha talks. So he's saying, for example, one of the misconceptions we have is that we believe someone made us, either your mummy or daddy or a creator. We believe this, you know, that we play no role, therefore we play no, this is a really interesting point, therefore we play no role in who we are. We get plonked on this planet by somebody else, ready-made. This is a demented idea for the Buddha. I mean, no wonder we're full of panic and fear. Someone, two wacky people decide to have sex and make you. And they give you anger and give you neurosis and give you jealousy. I mean, that's pretty monstrous. That's pretty shocking. That's pretty fascist. No, Buddha says they don't. They just give you a body, baby. You give yourself your own mind and you don't blame a creator either. And of those views, it's interesting. In the Buddhist perspective even, of those two views... Because the physical one, you know, doesn't bring much confidence, in my opinion. And it's kind of nihilistic. You get born, you're made by someone else, and then you die. Nothing left. That's like nihilism. At least if you have faith in a creator, there's some optimism there. And at least, you know, my way of saying it, at least somebody's got a plan. And if you have faith in God, you don't mind that you don't know, but you're prepared to trust him. That's a not bad way to live your life. But unfortunately, 99% of Christians and Muslims, and maybe Muslims, I don't know, have that faith in God. They moan and complain. But it seems to be logical. If you believe in a creator, he who is perfect and who knows everything and has a plan, then, you know, at least he's got his plan. He keeps it in his pocket. That's okay, but at least he's got a plan. You can have faith. I find that pretty powerful. But that's not the Buddha's view, that's all. This is not the Buddha's view. No one made you. You made yourself, baby. So there's all these misconceptions, and we have to argue with them. We have to listen to them first and think, well, okay, I'm prepared to take that as my working hypothesis. So how do you start to work with it? You start to learn the concept, and you state it, and that argues with the misconception. You start somewhere. So here with the concept of another misconception, because of our attachment, we then believe that what we are is permanent, unchanging. We will be together until we're 80. My house is beautiful today. Then you just assume your house will be there tomorrow. You assume your husband will be there tomorrow. Not true, Buddha says. It's a misconception. So we argue with it. So here, a teacher gets us right between the eyeballs, like I said, to get us to think about impermanence, to give us a wake-up call, to enable us to even want to bother to practice. So here we've got this precious life, and one of the first things he gets us to contemplate, even before impermanence, as we know, this idea of a so-called precious human rebirth. So he's kind of cobbled together various points and says, if we think about this, think of some of the advantages we've got. It's like those people in the internet that do these sort of surveys, you know, do this, the sort of 1.0% of people have a computer and 3% of people have this. And so, I mean, you realise you're part of that and you look, wow, I'm so fortunate. Same here. That's what our teacher gets us to do. We've got a decent human body. We have a reasonable intelligence. We have access to food and leisure. Therefore, we have access to money and food. And a place to live, which is like a miracle on this planet, which then gives us the miracle of of leisure to be able to have access to spiritual teaching so we can spend our lives usefully instead of just, you know, in the rat race. All of that we have. So how fortunate. The conclusion is how fortunate. And the action point is mustn't waste it. Then we increase our wish to not waste it. We increase our sense of urgency by realizing it could end at any moment. So the first step is to think about how death is definite. Well, this is evident to anybody with half a brain. We know that, and we think how boring to think about it. Why should I? I know this already. Well, no, we don't, he says. Instinctively, we frantically grasp at this sense of an unchanging me. That's why we get a shock every time we look in the mirror. Or someone stands up for you on the train now. If you realise you're in the old category. You still feel like you're 15, but suddenly you look like an old lady, you know. You get a shock because we don't have a sense of impermanence. We don't have a feeling for it. We don't have a feeling of things changing. We stay stuck, you know. It's very curious. So we've got to think about this. And how do I meditate on death is definite? So I close my eyes and I go, death is definite, death is definite, death is definite. No, that's stupid. You know, every time something happens that it reminds you, you go, wow, look at that, death's definite. So you look at the ant, who's bopping along, suddenly they're dead. Big shock to them, too. They thought they were permanent as well. Someone comes, you stand on them, you know, wow, dead, death is definite. Or you think that everything, now that's more the second point, which is the time of death is not definite. That should scare the life out of us. It's a fact. It's a scientific fact. This is not religion, it's not fear, it's fact. It's a scientific fact. That we do not know when we're going to die. We can speculate as much as we like, but we know that young people die, babies die, fetuses die. They haven't even had a chance to get born yet and they're dead, you know. Happy people die, healthy people die. So there's no logic to it, according to the materialist view. Unhealthy people live till they're 97. So there's kind of, where's the logic? We haven't got any. So the first thing is to start to get a sense that death is definite, which means I will die. So this is the interesting point. We can look at it in the outside world and see that death is definite. But until we bring it to ourself and say that that means I will die, my death is definite, it will never ring any bells. We will never get the message. It's got to be it's got to come to me. And that's where the second point. So let me, okay, the first point, death is definite. And you look at your beloveds. And you think, oh my God, they're going to die. That freaks us out. But it's still not enough learning until you go, I will die. The second one is much more intense. Again, logical, true. We do not know when we will die. So that really should scare the life out of us, which in a sense is what a teacher wants us to do, to get a wake-up call. But we can see the world, you know. People out there die. We read the news and have compassion, or read the news and get worried. None of that's the issue. We've got to make it, the only way to make it the learning is to go, that'll happen to me. That'll be me. That'll be me. Then, you know, then it starts to wake us up. Even when your beloveds die and you break your heart and you're devastated, that's not the learning yet. That's still not the learning. The learning is that will be me. When you're at the funeral of your beloved, your baby, which when you're just so shocked, you'll say, that'll be me. Then it becomes a learning. Then you get the point. Until you say, that'll be me, you will never get the point. Because there's this terrible hubris we have of being, you know, there's me over here. As Lama Zopa says, we think the whole world is divided into living people and dying people. It's a really interesting point. Think about when you hear about a person who's dying. You're shocked. We are shocked. We don't want to talk about it to them. We don't want to talk to them. If we do, we talk in kind of hushed, sad tones. We feel sorry for the person. There's this arrogance, this hubris. Oh, thank God I'm in the living category. Well, I'm very sorry, as Lama Zopa says. You know, we're all dying. This is not a cliche. It's just a question of time. Because we haven't been given a date. We put this lie in our mind that I'm a living person. It's utter nonsense. All these are conceptions in our mind. As Lama Zopa says, all these misconceptions, this is what one way he puts it, decorate on top of what is there, layers upon layers upon layers of characteristics that aren't there. That's a perfect way of describing what Buddha's saying. We impose qualities on things that they don't possess. So this misconception about permanence, we impose upon things, especially the ones you're attached to, the clock, if you're attached to your clock, you really impose a lie on it because you can't bear to not have it. You impose this lie that it won't change because you can't bear to think it will. We will be together till we're 80. Like, we are together permanent forever. It's just a lie because we can't bear the thought of things changing because we're so attached. So they all link together, these lies. You know, they all collude together to keep us living in lies. And this is directly and precisely the source of our suffering. It's an astonishing point to think about. We never would have thought for one second that we suffer because we have misconceptions. We suffer because of the weather, and we suffer because of the boyfriend, and we suffer because of the sickness. That's how we think. We never question it. It's a very interesting way to see it. So we've got to locate the misconceptions in the mind. That's when we start becoming Buddhist. So impermanence. So the third point is the conclusion, is the action point. Is the action point. What to do with all this information? Well, given that my consciousness is not physical, and given that my consciousness came from before this life and will continue after, and given that every millisecond of what I think and do and say will leave seeds in my mind, and given that every action that's labelled negative, and we'll go into this in more detail this morning to unpack that, that will ripen as my future suffering, and every action I do that's labelled positive will ripen as my future happiness, and given very simply that I don't want suffering and do want happiness, it follows logically. The conclusion, the action point is, stop, at least starting point, stop sowing more negative seeds. Bare minimum, first step. It's very simple. Like, given that you might get, that you don't want cancer, then the first step now is to start refraining from the actions that will cause the cancer in the future. We understand it when it comes to the body. We understand it. If you look in your garden and you see all these poison weeds eating up your herbs and flowers and you didn't know until now what they are and now you know, well, your very first step is stop growing more of them, and then next one is pull out the ones that are there. So logical. But of course, this view of karma, because it's so utterly different from how we think from the big picture point of view, that it takes a while for us to even think about it. It takes a while to hypothesize it. It takes a while to take it seriously. And that, of course, is up to us. No, we don't have to. We can decide. We're the boss of our life, you know. So the way the lamas all say, they say, once you've got a real sense of impermanence, it transforms your life. It immediately lessens grasping, it lessens fears, it lessens anger, it lessens attachment. It's incredible. And this is the first step, you know, getting a real sense of changingness. So I think a really good example of how we see we don't have that sense of our own self. You know, when let's say you live here and you go, what's your nearest town? Hexham. You go to your shop or your pub or something. And you know, you've done it a few times, so you're vividly aware. The moment you drive out the gate, you've got this vivid feeling, haven't you, of moving towards Hexham, which means moving away from here. And as you see all the signposts on the way, you know you're getting closer. And we have a real feeling of how long 30 minutes or 20 minutes takes, don't we? We know that because we've done it before. We have a vivid feeling of it moving forward. Well, look at our lives. Speaking very simply, from the second of conception up until death, we're moving towards death. There's one simple way of putting it, although it sounds insane to us. Actually, it's very interesting. In the 12 links of dependent arising, Buddha's teachings about how we create these entire cycles of rebirth every second, you know. The 11th link, what is it? Old age and death. The 12th link is called old age and death. So birth and then old age and death. So birth, according to this analysis, is the label given to the first moment of conception in your mother's womb. Birth. The beginning of this life in your mother's womb. When the egg and sperm come together and your consciousness comes from before and joins them. That's the beginning of you. So that's called birth. The next millisecond is called old age. From that second, it's downhill. Where's that person who's sitting there? Is she gone?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Here.
Oh, what do you move for?
Just got hemmed in.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I understand. I would too. Good. There you go. So it's very interesting, that feeling. It's hilarious to think that old age starts the second after conception. It's downhill from there. So I have to refrain when I see brand new babies. Oh, they're nearly dead already. Careful to say that to your mother, the poor mother. So, the wake-up call is, what I'm saying is, get the vivid feeling every time you wake up, you're moving towards death. Of course, it's appalling in our culture because we have so much attachment to this life and because we are materialists and we don't posit a thing called heaven or don't posit a thing called a future life. So there's a sense of awful urgency, isn't it, not to waste this precious life because it's going to end at any minute, but we can't bear to think about it because at the end, death, all you've got to look forward to is a black hole, isn't it? And who wants to look forward to a black hole? Nobody. So of course we live in denial of death. It's a horrible thought that all just everything ends. So it's kind of nihilism. But the approach here isn't to make you depressed to think you're moving towards death. It's the exact opposite. And I think in other words, get this sense of moving towards death. So the conclusion point here isn't panic, is I mustn't waste this precious opportunity. And I think we really understand that. I was just as an example. I remember when I was based in California, and when I was in Northern California, all the redwood trees are, which are lovely, but you know they're all drippy and wet. And I'd rather have the ocean, thank you. Because when you can't see the sky, all these trees, you know. Anyway, we like different things, don't we? And I remember our centre there, Land of Medicine Buddha, is in the redwoods, and it's all drippy and wet. And I sometimes go off and I do what I call an editing retreat. Go off and just do some editing. It's one of my jobs. So someone offered me a little spot in Puerto Rico, which is kind of this cute little place, 4 million people. They say it's one of the happiest places on the planet. People are very lovely. It's very tiny, 4 million people. America bought it, doesn't it? Because it's in the middle of that ocean there. It was very strategic, so they bought it. Like they bought Alaska, isn't it? Just go around buying countries. I often think, why can't you just go and buy Tibet from the Chinese? It'd be the best way. Politics are stupid, just use your money, you know. Buy Tibet. Probably cost a lot of money now. They put so much investment in it. If somebody's rich enough, just buy the place, you know. Anyway, so there you are, Puerto Rico. Sorry, I went off a bit. There's Puerto Rico. And I went there. Someone offered me a little spot on the south of the island in these little tourist places, you know, these little pink buildings. And so I had a little apartment and it was just near the sea. I could hear the sea and I love the sea. So I had 9 weeks there to do editing. Now, the point is this, very simple. Remember the lady called Rita gave me the key. And basically, the deal was, you know, think about it, that I've got 9 weeks. And at 9 weeks' time, I walk out the door and give her the key and say goodbye. So it's impermanent. And you've got a date. So then imagine if I forgot during my 9 weeks that it was impermanent. Imagine I start getting, all attached to all the things. And this apartment's my apartment. This is my cushion. This is my this. And you start getting attached to it and thinking it won't change. Then you wake up one morning going, oh, I can't be bothered going today. I can't be bothered going for a meal today. I can't be bothered doing some swimming today. Because you forget that it's changing. You forget that you've got to move out soon. So then, and that's what a holiday is. So with a holiday, you know it's impermanent. You know it will end. But you enjoy it all the more. You don't say, oh, what's the point of going on a holiday? I've got to leave. You don't say that. You enjoy it all the more. So the same with life. When you realize it's impermanent, changing moment by moment and moving towards its end, then you get a wake-up call and you enjoy it all the more. That's the whole point. And you won't grasp at things so strongly because you realize it's moving like a dream. So it's very practical. It's not fearful at all. But only because we've got attachment that is it fearful. Because we can't bear the thought that whatever it is will end, you know. So it's really practical. So we've got to cultivate a sense, a feeling of moving away from birth towards death. But the concluding point is, the action point is, mustn't waste it. So, you know, even though relatively speaking, that vague, you know, the holiday I had, even though I was editing every day. I'd swim every day, I'd go for walks every day, I'd go to the cafes every day, because I didn't want to waste it. It's exactly the point. So thinking about things as changing and moving is a good point, not a negative one. It makes you not want to waste it. It's very precious. That's the attitude here. So, of course, wasting this life, from the Buddhist perspective, is very clear. Wasting it is following our misconceptions, following attachment, following anger, following depression, following low self-esteem, following all the misconceptions. That's wasting your life, tipping it down the toilet. But the point here is to get this sense of impermanence and not want to waste your life. Then it gradually moves towards, you know, there's more points in there that they suggest we think about, but the essence of it is, okay, wasting, and not what does wasting it mean? You know, at least start by disciplining the servants of our misconceptions, the body and speech. Already, like we said yesterday, a profound level of practice, which demands enormous mental discipline. Because your body won't stop doing its thing on its own. Your mind has to decide not to say those words. Your mind has to decide not to put your hand out for the fourth piece. Your mind has to decide not to take that thing that doesn't belong. Your mind has to decide not to jump on someone else's partner. So it's pretty powerful practice, still mental, but you're harnessing the energy of the body and speech, which is what does the work, which is what harms others. So this very first level of practice, based upon wishing not to waste his precious life. There's logic to the thinking, you know. So let's look a bit more detail about what determines an action that we do, whether it's so-called negative or positive. Because again, there's only, based on this concept of these three poisons, attachment, aversion, ignorance, there's only really three options. Variations of a negative action, variations of a positive one, and then there's other ones called neutral. But we don't even bother with those here. Positive or negative, it's quite simple. Not complicated. So this is where too, in the Buddhist view, you know, you can very, like I said before, definitely Buddhism is a worldview about how things exist. It is definitely also a view as a philosophical presentation. It is also a detailed presentation of the mind and how it functions, of psychology, and it is definitely a system of ethics. It's all of these things together, and they all come to the same thing, which is very interesting. So what determines, so remembering the Buddha's view about karma, this natural law that runs the universe, or the law within which the universe runs, and no one runs it, no one's made it up, it's just the way it is, it's Buddha's observation, is that every millisecond of what we think and do and say programs us. It's a really, I think Buddha would have liked that phrase, sow seeds, and seeds do not go astray unless you do something proactive to pull them out. They'll either grow or you'll pull them out or destroy them, you know. So then second, every millisecond of what we think and do and say is either, broadly speaking here, a negative action or a positive or variations of them. So let's look at what determines that. What makes an action negative? And this is the crucial point. It's not someone else who decides. Buddha does his presentation, and it, you know, if that's the one we decide, that's the law we decide to use. We are the ones who have to look into our actions. There's no judge out there. There's no person who's going to judge you. You know, you have to. It's like if you're going to play music, you decide, you choose Bach's laws. So there it all is on the piece of paper on the piano, and he's got all these notes written down. And you're trying to play the piano, you don't just randomly make any old sound you like. You can if you want, but it's got a powerful system there. And how you determine whether the note you played is the right note or the wrong note is very simple. You look at the piece of music, and you check to see, according to Bach's view of music, is what you're playing in sync with that? Well, that's what we're doing here. Is, you know, it's not some absolute things in good or bad in their nature. Not absolute, no. It's a relative presentation of like, you know, Buddha's presentation of what makes something negative, what makes something positive. And it's up to us to look into this and to think about it. He didn't make it up. He's observed this. He says this is natural law. So in order for any action that we do to become what they call a complete action, which is an action that drops a seed in your main bank vault, which is the one that will determine the type of rebirth you get, which is triggered at the time of your death. So in our case, we can deduce that before we stopped breathing in the past life, a few weeks before we found our way to Mummy's fallopian tube, of one of our very powerful, intentional, non-harming, in particular non-killing karmic seeds was triggered, which is what produces a human birth. So for that action, to leave that seed in that bank vault and to be the one that produced this human life, what needs to be in place when we did that action of non-killing? Well, the very first thing, we'll just use the example, always use the same example, like an example of like a little mouse in your kitchen. The very first of there's four things that need to be in place. The first is, in this case, of an action called a conscious, intentional action of non-killing. Intentional, not merely not killing, but intentionally not killing. Is the presence of the object of that action, which is a living being. So there we have this mouse. Second, and this is the crucial piece, and there's two parts, or there's actually more, but I'll just keep it simple here. There's your mind involved in the action, and this is the major component. And there's two bits. 2A is intention, which here doesn't mean, oh, good intention. It means simply the bare bones, I must not kill this mouse. I will try and not hurt this mouse. I will try and save this mouse. Whatever the thought is, you know, intention, I will not kill the mouse. That's crucial. That's the meaning of the word karma. The whole process of creating karma starts with intention. And really the real meaning of the word karma is the word intention. It's like mental action. It means action. Karma means action. And it starts with mental action, which is intention, which is volition, which is I will. Everything we do starts with that, although we're not aware, because much of it's just programmed. As they say in Tibetan, as Lama Zopa quotes, everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought, I will. But we're programmed. So, you know, you see me stand up, and you will at some point, you know, I'll kind of walk a little bit forward and turn left and get out the door. I will do that probably. And you can guarantee that in my mind there was a thought, I will walk out the door. If there were not, I would sit here quietly, unless someone forces me. So it's so clear. Everything your body and speech does is driven by your mind. But that's a real shock to us because we don't even notice. Because why? Because we get born programmed by our habits. Programmed. Completely instinctive. An instinct. All instinct is the habit of having done something that often that it happens now virtually automatically. But intention has to be there, as subtle as it might be. If your mind doesn't say, I will walk out the door, your legs will never carry you through that door in 20 million years. Never. Intention. That's why we have to learn to know our minds and start becoming in charge of it. Because we're just like lemmings right now. Just follow our feelings, follow our instinct, you know. It's useless. So the intention, I will save that mouse. I will not kill the mouse. But the crucial second part, 2B, and this is the component that gives the character to the whole action, your motivation. Why? Compassion. Let's say, compassion. That flavors the entire action. And that's what causes it to become a virtuous action. Third, you do the action. You save them. You grab the mouse. Four, you release it. Thank you, Ravina. Happy mouse. That's a complete action of non-killing. And killing, exactly the same. Object is their mouse. Intention, I will kill the mouse. Motivation, disgust, aversion. How dare that mouse be in my precious kitchen? Three, you do the action. Four, dead mouse. There's more to it than that, but that's the essence. So the key factor there is the second one, your mind involved in it. And the key factor within intention and motivation is the motivation. That's what makes it, in this case, of virtuous action. Because look at this. You could have a mouse in your kitchen. There's a mouse. Second intention. Oh, I must be careful not to hurt the mouse. I must save the mouse. Your motivation. Attachment. You want to eat it for dinner later. You put it in the cupboard to keep it all fresh. Then you kill it. But it doesn't look like it right there. It looks like you've been kind, doesn't it? Saving this little mouse. Three, you do the action. Oh, little mouse, be careful. No, you're not being kind. Your attachment, your motivation is attachment. How disgusting. It's a negative action. Even though your motivation looks good. It's not. Now, if you know, the same thing. You have a mouse in your kitchen. So Lindsay has a mouse in her kitchen. Intention to kill it? No, no intention. She doesn't see it. Motivation? No, no motivation. She doesn't see it. Three, her foot goes on it. Four, it's dead. Zero karma. Mind has to be involved. Bodies don't create karma. Just carries out the wishes of the mind. You're walking past a person who's homeless. One, there's a homeless person. Two, intention. I will give $20, £20, whatever. Motivation, generosity. Three, you do the action. Four, they get the money. Complete action of generosity. Perfect. But let's say you walk past a homeless person and there's no intention, you have no intention to give them the money. There's no motivation, therefore no karma. Three, £20 falls out of your pocket. Four, they get their £20. Thank you, but you've made no karma whatsoever because there's no motivation, no intention. So mind is the key player. But the trouble is, because of eons of lifetimes, Buddha says, we wake up into this life completely programmed with our major habits. To eat, to whatever it might be that we do. That we then start to see our lives as we start to carry out our actions. We don't know where they come from. You know, like little children who can play Bach at the age of three. Mummy didn't teach them. We're all shocked by that. They've got obviously pretty strong imprints. Little boys who go fishing and love fishing, they've got a strong imprint. Mummy didn't teach. One other little boy, I always quote, the son of a friend of mine, she was taking the lice out of his head. He was crying with compassion for the lice. She hadn't taught him this. We come programmed with our own stuff. Not mummy's habits, not daddy's habits. Mummy and daddy might share those habits. No problem, because they've done them before. And then we conveniently get born to them where they can keep increasing feeding our habits. But our habits are our habits. That's the crucial piece about karma. But of course it's a shock because the Christian view doesn't have that and the materialist view, because in each case you begin in your mother's womb. The first moment of you is in your mother's womb. But the Buddha says we come with this massive past. We are the result of our own past. We are the creators of our own self. Kind of fascinating. So we better start learning and unpacking and unravelling and getting in charge of the process, not just being like a bunch of lemmings, following our feelings. And that's what we do now. Because it feels good, because we've done it before, we think it must be good. This is the tragedy. That's why it's hard to change, because habits are so deep. So, motivation is the key thing. So you could even argue, let's say Lindsay has a mouse and she sees the mouse is suffering terribly. So let's say we commonly think in our culture that you therefore must kill the mouse. We do that with our grandmother as well, don't we? We give it polite Greek names like euthanasia. Well, our fancy words, you put them into Greek, makes them special. I don't know why. So you could argue her compassion, she means well. She does mean well. She really thinks by killing the mouse, she's stopping its suffering. And she is stopping that moment of suffering. But what she doesn't take in mind, if she's not a Buddhist, doesn't have a view of Buddhism, let's say, which would suggest the consciousness of the mouse will continue. And depending on how it is when she kills it, if its mind's freaking out, and it's very likely to be freaking out, it'll just increase the likelihood that that'll trigger a negative seed and the mouse will be thrown from the frying pan into the fire. What good is that? So she meant well. You could even say she created some virtuous karma because she did was motivated by genuine compassion, but it was polluted compassion because it didn't have any wisdom. Meaning well is not enough, as Lama Zopa says. You need wisdom. That's a big shock to us. It takes a while to hear that one. So even killing, and maybe that mouse went from the frying pan into the fire, she not only didn't help it, she actually made it worse for the mouse. Nevertheless, you can't say she didn't create some virtuous karma because she was motivated by compassion. But that's why it is just not enough. Compassion is not enough. You've got to know, You've got to, you know, in other words, I've got a headache, and Lindsay's got such compassion for me. Rabina, please take this pill, darling, please. But she just forgets whether it's the cyanide or the aspirin. Well, thanks, I'd rather keep her pill to herself and leave me with my headache. Until you're certain that your action will actually benefit that being. That's a pretty intense one. We don't have much wisdom, so we act according to the wisdom we've got. Don't just rush in like fools, you know. So karma ripens, as I said, in four ways. One is a type of rebirth, like we're discussing here. And there's all these options for the Buddha. There's a whole spectrum of possibilities of rebirths, all actual, real, sentient beings, all with their own level of consciousness, all the way on the spectrum from the most intense bliss to the most intense levels of suffering, and all coming along with their own level of physicality. In the Vajrayana system, the more advanced system in Buddhism, that's mainly only really still extant in Tibetan Buddhism, Tantra, which is the system that, interestingly, that the Tibetan medical system uses, we're made up of gross consciousness, which is inextricably linked with this gross body. Then we have subtle consciousness, which is also inextricably linked to its own subtle level of physicality. The subtle wind energy, it's the same as yoga, similar to the Chinese system. These 72,000 subtle channels, like a subtle nervous system, through which are coursing these subtle wind energies or prana, all these kinds. This is the basis of health in those types of systems, the different wind energies. And then along with those wind energies, our different states of mind are all linked inextricably with those different levels of wind energies. It's a very different system, clearly. And whatever our mind does impacts upon those wind energies. And that's, so as Lama Zopa says, in the Kala Chakra Tantra, in all the texts, there are these detailed descriptions of the intimate relationship between internal and external energy. Internal is consciousness, mind, thoughts. External is the physical, and in this case, at the subtle level, is this subtle wind energy, all these different winds, these airs coursing through these different channels, inextricably linked to our states of mind. So everything we think, not to mention say and do, impacts upon those winds. So even as Lama Zopa says, being angry pollutes the wind energies connected to your anger. And your Tibetan doctor can feel, she feels your pulses. And she can feel those different winds, and she can feel the imbalance of this certain wind, which is why your mind's out of control, it's so angry and raging. She can feel that other wind, this is why you've got anxiety and panic attacks, which is your attachment. Because everything your mind does impacts upon those winds, and that karmically then creates sickness in terms of the anger one. Equally, if your mind is virtuous and pure and virtuous, and you practice that, that purifies your winds, which creates the course of future health. Literally, we are the creators of our future bodies, you know. And then over a longer period, as Lama Zopa says, over many, many lifetimes, the anger, for example, pollutes your wind energies, which causes sickness, and then in turn, eventually impacts upon the external elements, which it creates the eruption of the elements, the disharmony of all the physical elements. So having the disharmony of the physical elements, like all those fires in Australia, was the karmic result of probably a million lifetimes ago of all the sentient beings experiencing those fires from their own past anger and harming others, which then erupts as violent fires and everything is destroyed. Everything comes from minds and karma, which starts with minds. We don't need creators, Buddha says. It's an unnecessary additive. It's an embellishment. We create our own experiences, we create our own bodies, and we even create the universe, which sounds pretty cosmic, but it's all explained in detail in the Vajrayana teachings based on this concept of consciousness and matter, and there's only those two phenomena in the universes, and matter is the four elements, and all minds are inextricably linked to their own set of the four elements. This is what's just in the Vajrayana model, which I find very helpful to understand, you know. Very different system, very different model, very different presentation of the universe, you know. That's why all this stuff is up to us if we're interested in it. Don't have to be. So we're the boss. So very simply, if we're the boss, we don't want suffering. So that becomes the basis for practicing an ethical life. Like I said, don't feel ashamed about that. It's common sense. It's like not wanting to be sick in the future, so you start eating well. No one accuses you of being selfish. Well, then, my goodness, you've got to first recognize that you don't want future suffering, and that is the basis of your practicing good ethics. Eventually, it becomes, you also add compassion to the mix. But first, you start with compassion for yourself, with self-respect. When you realize everything you think and do and say will produce your future, and you don't want suffering, that's an incredibly powerful motivation. Never discount it. Got to have that first. Then you increase it, and it becomes compassion as well for others. It's very powerful. So a negative action is one that is done by our body and speech, is the heaviest level, that is motivated by a delusion. And a virtuous action, you know, a first level virtuous action, this very first level of virtuous action is a virtuous action of refraining from harming. We're not discussing actively benefiting yet. That comes in the compassion wing. That's more advanced level. We've got to first, at least by refraining from the negative, that's called an action. It's called a positive action of refraining from harming. Don't just think that's passive, merely not killing. It's profound, but it's driven by the intention. And then, of course, as the Buddha would say, Buddha loves his vows. He says vows are really precepts. Vows are very powerful psychologically. So he'd suggest we live in the vows of not killing, not stealing. There are five of them. Even though he has a little list, a longer list in this general list of 10 things, first seven being body and speech. When you take the vows and you first become a Buddhist, and some people apparently have asked about formally taking refuge in the five lay vows, and we're going to do that on Sunday for those who want it. So the vows are really powerful. So it's like this. What a vow is, you know, and we're talking here the formal Buddhist vows, is where you make a decision. You make a formal decision to refrain from certain things. Why? Because you don't want suffering. It's a way of programming your consciousness, your mind, with very strong positive action of not killing, not stealing, not lying, etc. So why a vow? What is it about that? And this, like I said, Buddha loves his vows. They say there's immense power psychologically with vows. And I've got a sense we understand that. You know, yourself, you can say, oh, I should eat less food. You know, I better eat less food. I should go on a diet. 27 years later, you won't. Until you say, I will go on a diet. You make a commitment. You make a decision. That's like a vow. When you consciously intend, you say, I will do it. And you make it like a, you know, you internalize that. That becomes powerful. That guides you every day. It's like sitting on your shoulder right there when you see the cake. I made a commitment. I won't do it. It's very powerful. It's very natural. It's very logical. You even think about it. We never think like this. But when you learn to drive a car, forget the road rules, just the car, just driving it. You never think of it this way, but you actually took, you know, you've got a list of about 1,000 vows. I will not put the foot on the brake and the accelerator simultaneously. I will not turn left the wheel left if I want to go right. I will not do this. I will not do that. Of course you have to say, you learn, that's what you mean by, that's what learning to do something is. As well as I will do this and I will do that. And you program your mind. Well, they're vows, for goodness sake. But we don't call them that. And as soon as we hear the word vow, we hear religion, then we get all neurotic, you know, like someone's squashing me. No, you're deciding yourself. So the point is, as Lama Zopa said, you can have a person who's got really good spiritual practice, but doesn't have any vows, does lots of practice day and night. Excuse me. And then you have a person who doesn't do much practice but is living in their five layperson's vows. No, even just the vow not to kill. They're living in that purely. He says the person who's merely living in their vow, the power of vows being such that 24 hours a day that they're keeping it, they're ticking over virtuous karmic seeds, even without intention. And putting atomic bombs under the karmic habits to kill. Something very potent psychologically about making a powerful decision that I will live my life according to the commitment, the vow not to kill. It's in your mind stream 24 hours a day. So what to think about that? And basically the way the Lama Zopa puts it, as the way Buddha puts it, you can't get ahead of the game without living in vows. In other words, just being good is not enough. And this sounds very depressing initially. That, in other words, our actions that are done motivated by good qualities like kindness and love and compassion or the wish not to harm are quite weak. Our attachment is pretty powerful. Our attachment really runs the show. And our virtuous qualities are quite weak. Whereas if you do an action in relation to a vow, if you do an action of non-killing, if you live in a vow of non-killing, that kind of pervades your mind continuously. Whereas the few times you do decide not to kill when you don't have a vow, it's only then when you intend, I will not kill, is when you meet that ant. But all the, I mean, we're sitting here right now, okay, not killing. But if there's no creature in front of us whom we have to decide not to kill, there's no intention not to kill, is there? So we're merely not killing. All the rats and roaches are happy. We're leaving them in peace. But we're not creating any virtuous karma of non-killing. We're just resting on our laurels. Whereas if we're living, sitting here with a vow not to kill, our mind's ticking over virtuous karma, ticking over and powerfully purifying. Like I said, we've got to think about this because it all sounds pretty abstract. We don't think this way normally. So we just can't get ahead of the game without vows. And the way Lama Zopa puts it also, he says, the life that we have got now, the human birth, the wish to become a better human being, the fact that we're even in this room for these few days, whether we're Buddhist or not, but we're at least looking into the meaning of life, all of this is because we've lived in very pure vows in the past. Just being good is not enough. It's a very interesting thing to think about. So the very first level of practice is to refrain from harming. The next one is to pull out the karmic seeds we've already planted from harming in the past before they ripen as our suffering. And that's called purification. This is the essence of the junior school practice. Abide by the laws of karma. Refrain from harming others. Live a life of good ethics. And then purify the actions you've already done in the past to prevent them from ripening as you're suffering. In other words, stop sowing more poison seeds and pull out the ones that are already there. That's the idea. So before we continue with that, are there any questions about what we've discussed so far this morning?
Just a few questions.
Yeah, yeah. What's your name again? I forget.
Dan.
I've got a list here. I'm trying to remember everybody. Where are you, Dan? Not here. Dan's not. There he is. You're here. You exist, Dan. Go on.
A few questions that came to mind. One,
yep.
One was, if you've realised emptiness,
yep.
then you wouldn't create karma.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
You'd stop creating. You've still got stuff to clean up. Uh-huh. But you've stopped the process. That's exactly right. Right.
So you're free of that.
But you've still got lots of stuff to purify yet. You've got a long way to go. You can't fall back again, but you've got lots of stuff from the past to still purify from the old stuff that's there, but you can't create more. That's right.
Okay.
More negative karma.
Yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
The other question was, in your example of walking out the door, there's the intention there to go out the door,
mm-hmm.
but there might not be any motivation.
Oh, there has to be. You wouldn't do it without one. There's always going to be some... otherwise, you'd be an insane person. Just go here and go there with no logic. Do you see my point? You'd have to be. And the motivation in this case would mostly be attachment. Usually, if we take it from the ethical point of view, it would be attachment to go where I want to go. But if it's to rush off and save a person, or could be rush off and kill somebody, if you think about it. But the usual one that even motivates the action of walking it depends on where you're walking. If I'm walking to lunch, what's in my mind is attachment to get lunch, you know?
Intention
on its own is walk out the door, then it's just like an action that has no meaning. It's an action that has no meaning.
So generally our actions will have some sort of meaning.
Always have a motivation.
Always have a motivation.
That's what really drives the intention. It's like the energy behind the intention, yeah.
So walking out that door could be a negative action.
Absolutely. Well, you could say, I mean, the action, okay, the action itself of walking out a door. No, it's an interesting point, isn't it? From the second that I decide I'm going to walk out the door because I want to kill you, from that second it's negative all the way. Of course, everything I do from that second is motivated by the wish to kill you. And to get to you, I've got to walk out the door. You know, it's a bit of a drag. I want to kill you right now. Do you understand? So everything I do to get there is the walking out the door. You can say like that, you know. But just the action itself of walking out the door is really a neutral action.
Uh-huh.
You could argue it's a neutral action. It's not, it doesn't have the, you know. But, I mean, I don't know. You think about it. Every action, putting a knife in somebody in its nature is neither negative nor positive, because you could be a surgeon. So putting a knife in somebody is neither good nor bad. It's a neutral thing on its own. It's got to be motivated by something to give it some character. If you think of it that way. Do you understand?
Mm.
Putting food in the mouth is no meaning until you have a motivation to either kill yourself or nourish yourself. Think about it.
Or it could be attachment. I mean, it could be attachment to have more.
No, intention itself is just bare bones, I will. And then it's the motivation. And these things, totally two come together. We can't see the difference, mostly.
Mm.
You know, for example, I always think of, like, you think of, I always think of one example of some monkey or some chimp or ape, or I can't remember what, who's particularly attached to sex. And when this little baby gets born, say a baby boy, monkey, or whatever he is, he gets born. Well, the second he's born, he turns around and has sex with his mummy, and then his daddy, and then his sister, and then his uncle, and then his auntie. Very attached to sex. So that's, the habit is so intense that every action he does is motivated. The intention and habit, the intention and motivation are completely oneness, you know. You can't possibly separate them. And that's how mostly we are now, too. Intention to do anything is all motivated by attachment. Even when we do good actions, there's a masses of attachment there as well. So this attachment is very deeply programmed. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, in general, when the Buddha states, like he presents this list of 10 actions that are in their nature negative. So killing is in its nature negative. Generosity in its nature is positive. But then, it's not enough to say that though. You've got to then start to look into what the motivation is at the time, and that'll be a thing that'll factor in and will moderate or increase that action. In general, you've got to start somewhere with labelling what is an action that harms an action that harms another. In general, at the heaviest level, that's labelled a negative action. And then depending on each person, how they do it and the habit they've got and their motivation, it could be worse for some and less for others. But in general, you've got to start with stating there are some actions that are virtuous and there are some actions that are negative. And then it's very nuanced according to the person, the time, the space, the motivation, the intensity. Many other factors factor in for each person. Do you understand? And in the end, but finally, because of emptiness, because things have no intrinsic nature, you can say that killing, especially if you're in your, let's say you get to the level of being a bodhisattva, well, it depends on how highly evolved you are. But if you've realized emptiness and cannot do actions based on attachment or aversion, then everything you do can only be beneficial, can only be virtuous, even killing. And that's logical. We've got to think it through because it sounds a bit shocking. Because your motivation is so pure and it's filled with such wisdom that you know it's the most beneficial thing for that person. Now, that's, we don't play with that. You can't play with that. But that's logical when we understand these different things. But in general, so you can start with, you know, there are some actions that are negative, some are positive. In general, the same with nutrition. We can decide that some foods, in general, have good nutritional value. And in general, some don't. But we all know a person who's got an allergy to peanuts will die in a second. So it depends on many other factors that come into it that makes it something. You've got to start somewhere with some basis, you know. And that's why the first level of practice, there's no wiggle room. You just back off and don't do actions with your body and speech that harm others. I don't care about your motivation. Just don't do it. It's a very powerful discipline. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
You sure? Got a question there?
I suppose that there is a question there. It's going to come out.
Go on. Now, these are really important things. I mean, they debate on these things to a great extent, you know.
I mean, that sort of basic level of...
You've got to start somewhere. You've got to start, you know, with your garden. You've got to start with the principles, a flower, a weed, a herb. But as you get progressed, more sophisticated, you can even learn to use weeds as... You can be brilliant. You've got to start somewhere with some fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. But I suppose that thing of refraining can be that you don't, you just suppress.
No, who said that?
Not me. Well,
you just did. No, you don't. What do you mean suppress?
I mean, that's how you can take it, isn't it?
No, that's not the meaning. No, that's just childish and panic-stricken and like a baby. Because I might get punished, I'm a naughty boy, I won't do it. Excuse me. If you don't want cancer, you will merely not have that cigarette. That's not suppress. That's just not, it's refusing to follow your craving to have a cigarette. You just won't do it. Come on, that's proactive, powerful decision to make. Intelligent decision. That's the point about karma. Not just don't do it, oh, I'm scared, suppress. No, suppression is idiocy. It's a conscious, intentional decision to not kill. Why? Because you don't want negative seeds in your mind because you don't want future suffering. You've got to be really alert to that first. And then you add compassion after that. When you even avow, you even take the vows based on your wish to try and purify your mind and practice virtue. So then your vow 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping, you're ticking over virtuous karma. And that's perhaps why the vows are so powerful. But the action of refraining from killing is you know, normally is strong in intention. I will not kill. Not just merely not killing, even. Not suppressing anything. If you like, suppressing your wish to kill, yes. But suppress feels like denial. But it's consciously deciding not to eat that sugar. Consciously deciding not to smoke that cigarette. Consciously deciding not to kill. It's very proactive. Someone else? Yeah.
I'm thinking of some actions don't have a motive. Think of a person.
Some actions what?
Don't have motivation. I'm thinking of a person who has this condition that in their sleep they sleep. I mean, husbands have killed their wives, and because they have been dead asleep, and they have, what is the expression? They've been completely asleep, and they have attacked.
That's your subtle consciousness playing it out. Well, that could be spirits. See, that could be spirits. That's the Buddhist view. That could be some other being taking you over and using your body to do the action. That's very not uncommon.
So what's the karma then?
Well, it depends. If it's a spirit, you didn't create much karma. You couldn't have. Your mind's not involved. I mean, that's if you take. You have to take the view, first of all, there's a possibility there are beings called spirits who are malevolent and whom you have karma with and who are using your body to do. This is very, among the Buddhists, in the Buddhist view, that's a very typical thing. So I remember, who was it, that fellow years ago? The something killer, the Ripper. What was his name?
Yorkshire Ripper.
That's the one. No. The fellow who went, kept going and killing all the prostitutes.
No.
More recent. Was that the Yorkshire Ripper? The newspapers are so evil, aren't they? That's the one. That's the fellow. I remember reading him. It was fascinating to me. I remember one time because he said what would happen was he'd be told to do it. That's how people who are possessed by spirits. Okay, for those who haven't heard of this, the Buddha would assert there are lots of other beings besides humans and animals, and there's one particular realm of existence who are kind of what they call spirits. And spirit is not a good word here. They're really intensely suffering people, driven by attachment. You've been a human in the past, and due to strong attachment, you get born as a spirit. So people who are possessed, people who talk about being possessed, hearing voices, they're spirits who literally, not every time, it can be your own crazy mind, but a common analysis among the Buddhist ones and the great practitioners and the yogis and also the Tibetan doctors who are clairvoyant can see literally. They are literally hearing voices. So this, I remember reading, you probably call it God, you can call it whoever you like, you think God's telling you what to do. So he'd be compelled to go and kill. And he said one time, and I was very moved by this, he said one time I was doing it, he'd go at midnight, late, and he'd be driving the car, and his own voice kept saying to himself, I don't want to do it. And he slammed his foot on the brake and he turned around and he went back. He said he felt so happy that he didn't follow this voice, Of course, the papers don't believe him. They think he's a maniac. I mean, imagine being that. Imagine having just your body used. That, for him, you could argue there can't be much negative karma for him. He's literally, his body is used by other beings, Of course, the West doesn't believe that.
How does that tie in with sort of being diagnosed as
psychotic or
well, that's the Western. That's the Western analysis.
It's the same thing.
It's just not every time. It's just the Western analysis because we don't posit the possibility of other beings. So we just say they're hearing voices and they're making it all up.
And give it the label schizophrenia.
And we give it a label schizophrenia. I mean, there's it's way more. I mean, there's so many variations of it, but one of the common ones will be that. I remember vividly a woman. I mean, no, so many examples I've heard of. Of course, I'm taking this view as my hypothesis, so I'm using this as an hour. I can't tell you I'm right, but this is the view I'm using until I'm clairvoyant. I can't say it's right. But I remember one woman who started contacting me by email from Canada. She emailed, and she liked Lamayeshi. She found my email, and we'd write for a couple of years. And she was incredible. She described her experience. She said she's sitting in a cafe one day, and all of a sudden she felt strongly some energy come into her left side. And since that time, more than one person inside screaming, abusing her, squashing her body, harming her. I mean, you either think she's mad or this is true, one or the other. There's only two options, right? So I took her view as real. And I remember she was an incredibly kind person. She was such a sweet person. She had to live with, she couldn't sleep for weeks. She was utterly tormented by this suffering, you know. Of course, in the end, she's telling, I think, her father, and then she stopped emailing. I think her father must have, you know, put into a crazy person's home or something. I don't know. Whatever, whatever. But I remember even asking Lama Zopa to do prayers and practices for her. But it just seems like sometimes it's so strong. The connection between that being and that person is so strong, nothing can help them go away. And one of the common practices among the Lamas is, you know, the Christians would call it, what's the term? Getting rid of the, they call it the devil, exorcism. But it's not the devil, they don't call it, there's different, these different spirits whom you have karmic connection with, who are literally, literally harming you. Many people have these experiences, hearing voices, people talking to them. Some are quite benign, some aren't harmful. This is spirits, you know. I remember one story, so many stories. I remember one story, Geshe Lama Khontrog, our amazing Yogi Lama, incredible. He lived at Kopan for years. He might have, I mean, he hasn't come here. This place wasn't existing. But he's been to England, I'd say. Been to here. Geshe Lama Khontrog, an amazing yogi, meditator. Lived up in the mountains for years and years, you know, meditating up in the caves. And he had developed this common quality, fairly low level, from these great yogis of clairvoyance. They can see the past, see the future, see the minds of others. And the ones, the greatest yogis, can live. I mean, he lived up in a little hole in the wall in 6 foot of snow in the winter with no clothes, no food, no sleep. Doesn't need it because they completely controlled their body, speech and mind, you know, at a subtle level using these Vajrayana meditation system. Anyway, he became known to the villagers. Well, they would rely on him. He'd change the weather. They can manipulate the external elements as well. So he would change the weather, he'd just, whatever. So anyway, he was in his cave one time and some of the nuns from the local nunnery who he was helping came up crying, Annie Tenzin's gone crazy, Annie Tenzin's gone crazy, you know, this nun. So he went down and he went in and there she was in the bed, this nun, speaking with a very deep voice. And he's clairvoyant, so he can see there's a being in there, a spirit, using her body. And he can see, of course, he knows, it's, apparently there's this, It turned out to be a recent villager who passed away. And a spirit will come into you, possess you. I know it sounds so strange if you don't have, accept this view, you know, it sounds hilarious. But, you know, you have karmic connection with people. We have karmic connection with people. It's not random. So you have karmic connection with people in human form. Some will be loving and kind and some will harm you. Well, these spirits are usually very distressed, very driven by attachment, very very, very obsessed, very crazy, and they have connection with you. And often they want something that you've got. Well, the first thing Geshe-la says to her, to him, the spirit in the nun, what do you want? Why are you here, in other words? I want my pink thermos with the fat flowers. I want my pink thermos with the white flowers, he said. So they look around and there's the thermos. And they remembered the local villager who just passed away had given this nun, and they're all very poor up there, his little precious thermos with tea, and she forgot to give it back. Well, he's annoyed, he's upset. So he dies with his attachment to his bloody thermos, you know, and gets reborn as spirit running after his thermos. I know it sounds hilarious. So, you know, it's so distressing. And so because he knows, the villager knows Genlan knows the villager, who's able to help. Because he's very powerful, so he enables the spirit to leave that body and then get a decent human rebirth or something. But I remember the spirit's crying and saying, "I can't find my way. I can't find my way." Because when you're a spirit, you got subtle wind energy as a physical body, but you can go. You flip from pillar to post, going here and going there, entering animals, entering humans, berserk, out of control, intense suffering type of rebirth, intense, unbelievable suffering. Remember another example at Kopan Monastery, the same lama, this girl who was Jewish, and she kind of went berserk, and he said, oh, yeah, she's possessed. And he said, she's got some object in her luggage that the spirit is connected to, is attached to. So they discovered this Jewish thing that her father said. She said her father had bought in an antique store. I always have second thoughts about buying things at antique stores now, because you're going to bring along, you're going to attract the spirit who used to own it as a human, you know. So he's probably annoyed because she's now becoming a Buddhist or something. So he possesses her. He wants his thing back. Well, again, I didn't know this particular person. And one of the methods they use, and I've seen the lamas do this, is very hilarious. They use very... What's wrong? What happened? Where's she going?
Somebody's upset.
Oh. We'll have a little hug first. Okay, what are you doing? Okay. All good. Okay. So this this girl, he didn't know her. So one of the methods they use, and I've seen the lamas do it, and some of them use a very peaceful method, some use quite wrathful. He was beating her, beating the spirit. They throw away the object, so to cut the connection, and then they shout and yell, we know all about you, leave here now, you go. And they often do. But this, my friend in Canada, no matter what they did, what the lamas did, nothing would make the spirit go away. The karma's too strong, you know. But I think hearing voices, I mean, some of you people in this room, you've heard things, people, you see things in your dreams. It's so not uncommon. But of course, in our materialist world, there's no way to explain it, you know, and the people just think you're crazy. Anyway, maybe any questions about all that?
I think there's several different explanations. I mean, I've worked with people who do hear voices.
This is the Buddhist explanation.
Yeah.
Are there others? But I'm just giving you the Buddhist one.
Okay, but I think that, I mean, it's not either or. Sometimes you can
not what
some,
either or what.
So some people come with an experience that they're having, and quite frequently there can be some kind of hidden intention, or there can be some type of...
No, I'm only talking about those who are spirits. I'm not saying everybody who's crazy is possessed by spirits. I'm not saying that.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that sometimes something can appear and it can be understood, or it can be treated with a psychological explanation, and it can be quite successful.
That means it's not a spirit.
Yeah.
I'm only talking about those who are spirits.
And that's my point, what I'm getting to. And sometimes you can have... a person or a client or a case.
A what?
You can have a patient. You can have a patient. And so there can be quite a lot of times a very strong psychological explanation about forms of depression, such as so forth.
That's not a spirit.
Yeah.
I'm not discussing them.
No, I know. I'm getting there.
But you keep saying you're getting there, but you don't get there.
I'm getting
there.
So
get there.
I'm getting there. But sometimes things happen which don't fall into that that kind of Western psychological explanation. Then you've got something a little bit different. So sometimes things like that can happen where... it would be the Western psychological explanation caught quite summing up.
Well, darling, that's what you're just repeating what I'm saying. I agree with you.
Yeah, I'm saying it's not either or, though. I mean,
it is either or.
Right, in what sense?
Either you're possessed by a spirit or you're not. What do you mean it's not either or? Of course it's either or.
Yep, but some of these human voices, I mean, experiences, sometimes it can be a psychological explanation.
But it is either that or you're possessed by a spirit. There's either either or. It is either or.
But they can both appear in the same way.
So what? It's still either or, though.
Yeah, I'm thinking how you actually define spirit or not spirit. Or
well, it is a real... if it's a spirit, it's a spirit. But unless you're clairvoyant, you won't know that. So it's only the higher beings and the yogis and the lamas who can see it's a spirit. Unless you're clairvoyant, you won't know that. That's what I'm saying here. Right. Do you see my point?
I do see your point. And what I'm thinking about, and maybe it's take too long, is how they mesh. So it's a big question of how they mesh. So if you do have...
Now, what meshes?
Okay, so if you have an external spirit... Yeah, that person is affecting their own particular way by that, so their own...
What, darling? Say it again.
Okay, so if there was a particular spirit that possessed that person...
That's right.
Yeah, but the way that person would express that distress is through their own karma, through their own psychology.
Yeah, but all of those things... So why are you saying all this?
Why am I saying that?
To explain it to yourself, or what?
No, I just think that...
Are you asking a question or stating something?
I'm asking a question.
You're asking a question. Good, ask the question then.
I think I'm actually... I'm stating something which is an implied question.
Okay, good. So what's the question? And I'll see if I can answer it. I don't know if I can.
Yeah. I think that... my statement is, I guess, that you... Sometimes it's... One has to be very... Maybe... has to be careful about applying something. So we say it's a spirit.
Who has... Stop. Who has to be careful?
I think we all do.
No, stop. Wait a minute. Just speak for yourself.
Okay.
Don't give lectures. I mean, I'm lecturing. It's my job. It's my job, though. I'm hired to do that. So listen, darling, if you don't give a general statement like that, you talk for yourself. You talk for yourself now, not some other people. So say it in your own eye. Say it from subjective point of view. Say your point from your point of view, not somebody else's. It's important.
My point of view is that I think we need to be...
you have to be... No, no.
Okay.
You speak as an I, subject, first person, not third person. Don't give it, say that other people should be careful. You mean I need to be careful when I see people so that I don't make a wrong assessment. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh, what are you saying then?
I'm saying that... Okay, it's a bigger point. I'm saying about how we can be impacted.
No, I don't want you to say we. I want you to say I. It's a really important point.
I see what you're saying,
otherwise, it's not applicable. There's no meaning to what you're saying. Try and hear my meaning for a second. Please, I beg you.
Go ahead.
You're working with people. You're working with people who can be crazy. So what you're suggesting is I've got to be careful. I have to be careful in assessing what the situation is. Because if I'm not qualified, I can't. That's what you should be saying right now.
What I'm saying is I'll say I.
Thank you.
I'll force it into I.
Good.
I feel a responsibility to challenge anything that could be dogmatic.
What do you mean by dog? What do you mean? What are you saying?
So if we look at people who have certain forms of mental...
No, say I. You've got a person in front of you. Don't make it a general statement. Say you got a client in front of you. What's your fear that you might do something wrong? Make it you, not other people. Make it you.
My fear.
What are you saying?
My fear, and it takes something away if I say I, but my fear is is that I would actually
And you said the word dogmatic. Now we're getting to. Now I'm getting to what you. Now you're getting to what you're really meaning, and now it's coming out. So what do you mean dogmatic? What's dogmatic mean?
So somebody appears in a certain state.
What does dogmatic mean? I'm asking you a question. What does dogmatic mean?
I'm asking the question. I'm trying to get to the question.
No, I want to cut through to you. I'm debating with you. What does dogmatic mean?
Dogmatic.
Because that gave me the key to what you're meaning.
Okay, I'll give you a particular instance.
What does dogmatic mean?
Okay, I'll give you a particular instance.
Good, darling. Good.
So if someone appears to you that a form of suffering.
So there's a person in front of you who's suffering.
Yeah.
Okay, so then, go.
Then you have to be...
Have to be careful to do what?
You have to be very careful that you're seeing that as clearly as possible.
Stops right there. You're now finally getting to the point. If you're not qualified, you shut your mouth. If you're not qualified, you cannot say it is a spirit. So unless you are clairvoyant... You cannot say it's a spirit. So be very simple. It's just how you're making it so complicated. So if you're not qualified, you can't make an assessment. End of result. Well, do your best to help the person. Give them a hug.
It goes the other way. If you're not qualified psychologically, you can't say it's a spirit because you don't know if it's not psychological. So it goes both ways.
No, it doesn't. If you cannot know it's a spirit because you're not clairvoyant, then the best you can do is help them psychologically. The best you can do is love them and take care of them and be kind to them. Dogmatic has got nothing to do with it.
But psychology is not just about... love and compassion.
I'm talking about psychology from the Buddhist point of view, baby. I don't know about Western psychology. I'm talking about having knowledge about the mind based on you having knowledge about your mind so you can be qualified to help that person. That's what I'm talking about here, psychology, not your psychology. I'm not being sectarian or dogmatic. I know I sound it, but I'm not being. Because that's the whole point here, darling. This is my entire point in this conversation about the wisdom wing and the compassion wing. The psychology we're describing here is the knowledge you get is from working on your mind, going to see you do your retreats, your intention, your this. You see your mind, your attachment, your anger, your jealousy, your neurosis. That informs you to help you become a better person, and that is what helps you to know the other person. I'm not talking discussing psychology you study in a book.
I agree with
that's
you.
Not what I'm talking about.
I agree
so then you are qualified to help the person according to your capacity. Dogma has got nothing to do with it. That sounds like a communist policeman, and nobody is suggesting you be that way.
On the first point, I agree with you completely.
Well, that's all then. So then you finally came at what you meant. Thank you very much. So you better be careful and not be dogmatic. I agree with you.
I'll try not to.
Everyone else can. You mind your own business and don't tell people what to do.
Right.
Because that's what you're doing. We should be careful not to be dogmatic. It is a danger. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure telling people what to do.
You are. Your statement is we.
Well, I see the impact of dogma around us in the
world. Well, that's I'm not discussing that here in this room. So where's the danger of dogma here?
I just think if one thing is described in one way, there's nuance to certain things. There's nuance. I believe there's nuance. And I think one just...
No, there's facts. Buddhist point of view, there's facts.
There are certain facts, but I think facts need to be qualified by certain ways. I mean,
but that's including that. So, I mean... But still, the essence, conclude this discussion now. What's the, so say in one sentence, the essence of your point. One sentence. One clear sentence, which is your conclusion from this. What's your conclusion from this in one sentence?
Beware of certainty.
Ah, that's bullshit. Utter bullshit. Because you're suggesting there's such a thing as certainty. And that's a typical Western view.
No, I'm not saying beware of certainty.
Well, then if you're not certain, If you are certain, you're certain, and if you're not, you're not. So there's nothing wrong with certainty. Certainty is necessary. You need to be certain that 1 + 1 = 2. You'll be in serious trouble if you're not certain. And if you think you're certain and you're not, you're in more trouble. So excuse me, that is rubbish. I debate with that utterly. Nothing wrong with certainty when you know what you're talking about.
In certain aspects, I think.
No, when you know what you're talking about, certainty is necessary. How can you help anybody if you're not certain?
Yes.
And if you're not certain, be humble enough to know you're not certain. So don't make...
Which is what I'm saying.
But you didn't say it that way. No. You mean if you're not certain, be careful to think you're certain. That's called arrogance.
Not just be aware of
certainty. No, not be aware of certainty. If you are certain, don't be aware of it. Be aware of it, and that's perfect. Then you can help me. But if you think you're certain and you're not, you're beyond arrogant and you're not qualified. That's what you're saying. Then I agree with that one. Are we communicating or not?
We're starting to communicate, which is great.
Well, I'm hoping you're communicating with me. I'm being arrogant now. What else, people? Well, do you want a break? Have a tea break, I'd say. Have a tea break?
Yeah.
Or a something break? Okay, go on then. Yeah, 10:30 is about time. Thank you, dearest. I'll see you in half an hour. Well, I'll sit here for a minute. Go. No, you go. I'm staying.